Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm the executive producer of this show and a couple of others, and I love all things tech. And it is time for a classic episode of Tech Stuff. This episode originally published way back on October 13th, 2014. It was about a topic that I didn't think, when I first started going into it, was going to be particularly interesting or have any controversy around it. I was incredibly wrong. This is The Sewing Machine. Enjoy.
We want to talk about patent wars. And we've talked about patent wars on Tech Stuff before. Patent wars are when you've got at least two, but sometimes multiple entities all claiming ownership for some kind of technology and competing against each other and sometimes taking each other to court and saying nasty things about each other's moms. And you might think that that's a pretty recent activity. You know, the smartphone, that's a big patent war, right? The
smartphone war. Lots of modern viciousness around patents.
But here's the thing, that modern viciousness has a long and detailed history that we can trace back to one of the most important pieces of technology. I am not using hyperbole, people. This is true.
Well, to me, it's certainly a super important piece of technology.
I mean, when you look at mass production, this is one of the specific pieces of technology that makes mass production possible. I'm talking about sewing machines.
Yes.
So sewing machines, as it turns out, were the focus of one of the first major patent wars. And the story is a complex one filled with joy and tragedy.
And a lot of crabbiness.
Yeah, and some stitches and thread, needles. There are a lot of needles.
A lot of that. If any of your listeners have listened to the Stuff You Missed in History Class episode on this very thing, a lot of this will be repeat information.
Yeah.
But it's just so fascinating how completely similar to modern day arguments over tech these ones were. I mean, it's
you can draw direct parallels.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's very similar.
Seriously, when you look at a company trying to make a piece of technology as complex as, say, a tablet or a smartphone. Now, a tablet or a smartphone by itself is one thing, but it's made up of numerous individual components, some of which may not be owned by one particular entity. Same thing is true with sewing machines, as it turns out.
Absolutely.
So before we jump into the sordid history of the sewing machine, I thought I would remind folks what a patent is, what it's all about. So patents are, it's a set of exclusive rights granted by a government, some form of agency that has authority, to an inventor or an assignee for the use of an invention. Now, an invention does not have to be a complete thing all by itself. It could be a component of a thing. Like if you were to have a full invention, let's say it's a washing machine, because we've done a Tech Stuff episode about washing machines. And you come up with a way to improve washing machines so that they wash clothes more thoroughly or without as much bashing around, so the clothing doesn't take as much of a beating. And you come up with that improvement, and then you patent it. You can do that. That's perfectly acceptable. And then any washing machine that would use that particular improvement would have to either have been made by you or have received your permission to use that specific technology.
Yes.
So patents can be for a full invention with all the different components, or it can be just a tiny little thing that's an improvement. The point of it is, the reason why you would want to patent it is that you get those exclusive rights to use that technology. Now, in return for that, you have to disclose how that technology works. You submit a patent application that has a full description of the mechanism and the purpose of your invention, and that becomes publicly available. And once the patent expires, which they do, anyone can access that information and make use of it. But during the course of that patent, the lifespan of that patent, it's all you, boss. They got to come through you.
Yeah, although that is an interesting one related to what we're talking about today, because there were several instances on the road to the sewing machine actually becoming a fully fledged thing, mm-hmm. where there were some fibs told in the patent filings, yep. so that they could keep their proprietary information to themselves.
Right, yeah.
So when people tried to replicate them, they did not always work.
Right, see, you could, if you wanted to, if you invented something, there's nothing that requires you to get a patent. You could keep it secret and say, this magical technology is mine and mine alone. But the danger of that, of course, is if someone gets hold of it and figures out how it works, they could then make the same thing with, and you would have no protection. Not only could they make the same thing, they could file a patent for it, and then you would no longer be able to use the thing you invented.
Yeah, it's all about first rights.
Yeah, so as it turns out, and we haven't even gotten into the complication of filing for a patent in one country versus filing for a patent in another, but we've hemmed and hawed long enough about patents. Let's start off. Tell me what was sewing before the sewing machine?
Well, most people would probably recognize it. If they thought about pre-sewing machine sewing, they would think of a needle and thread. But even way before that,
yeah.
there were people using bones and sticks to kind of poke holes into fabrics, usually leathers, and then they would pass a lace through. It was not all one continuous thing where the lace was attached to the bone or stick.
Right.
And then they added the eye, that circle that the whatever your lacing material passes through.
Right, the thing that confounds me whenever I have to thread a needle.
Many people say that.
Yeah.
I think you either got it or you don't.
Yeah, I don't got it.
I hope I keep it forever, because I have a few friends who are saying they're getting to the age where their eyesight isn't letting them keep it anymore. But yeah, so that eventually that eye was added, and people were able to do it all in one fell swoop where they poked the hole and passed the binding material through. And that also developed things like embroidery. But it wasn't really until the Industrial Revolution that stitching became mechanized. And even pre-Industrial Revolution in the mid-1700s, mm-hmm. where kind of industry was first starting to get seeded, mm-hmm. is really where we started having first people on record actually filing things.
Right. So you have Charles Wiesenthal here, who received a patent for a needle for a sewing machine, but it had a distinct disadvantage in that it was a design for a needle for a machine that didn't exist.
Yeah, he just really felt like he had the needle situation worked out, and eventually the rest would follow.
Right, you've got to really nail the needle is his approach,
which
right?
Which is true.
It is
the
true.
Needle, how it came to be where it is today, really took a lot of iterations. And his needle was pointed on both ends, and it had an eye, but the eye was in the middle, which is not, if anybody knows a modern
right.
sewing machine or hand sewing needle, the eye is usually not in the middle.
Right. So then we move forward to 1790. We have Thomas Saint, who I love the title of his patent.
We talked about this in the history podcast.
It's so succinct.
It's so delightful.
Yeah.
And just completely verbose. Do you want to read it?
Oh, sure.
It's so
let me do this. All right. So he's an English cabinet maker. So sorry, listeners. Here we go. An entire new method of making and completing shoes, boots, splatterdashes, clogs, and other articles by means of tools and machines also invented by me for that purpose, and of certain compositions of the nature of Japan or varnish, which will be very advantageous in many useful applications. End quote.
Don't you just feel like this is sewing as described by a Monty Python sketch?
It does feel like John Cleese is the person who needs to deliver that patent title.
For me, it's Terry Jones, but we all have our favorites.
That's fair. You went more Welsh. That's all right. Everything's fine with that.
So he's actually describing three different machines in this patent.
Okay.
So the second of the three, which is why it's so crazy wordy.
Right.
I mean, Japan and varnish, which are the words used for like these coating methods, have nothing to do with stitching, but
right.
He kind of lumped everything together.
Well, and he was a cabinet maker. So.
I think maybe he didn't like to file a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, it's probably one of those things where he thought, oh, goodness gracious, this is a lot of work. Let's just lump it all together, shall
we? One very wordy document will cover me.
Yeah.
So the second part of his patent was actually the one for stitching. And it really wasn't terribly practical. It had a lot of components that we actually associate with modern sewing machines. So it had the arm with the needle. It had continuous thread from a spool. And it had a table set up that the cloth would sit on, and those all still persist in some form or another. But his is a case where there's no actual example of his machine having been built. Mm-hmm. Although, in 1873, Newton Wilson, who was from Great Britain, found the plans, and he did build this machine, but it did not work. And this is one of those ones that we talked about a little bit ago, where the suspicion is that he didn't entirely disclose what he was getting
right.
at.
Right. Leave a few things out of the patent design so that folks don't automatically go out there and actually start making one. One thing about patents, by the way, there's no guarantee that your design has to work. I mean, it has to be reasonably, the people at the patent office have to reasonably believe that you believe it will work the way you've designed it. But you don't have to prove.
Yeah, there's not a proofing stage.
It's your design, yeah. You don't have to bring one in and say, well, here, let me put it in motion and show you that all the parts move the way I've described it in the patent. It really is just meant to prevent other people from making that same design without your permission first.
Yep.
All right, well, then in 1804, we've got this story about Thomas Stone and James Henderson, who were issued a patent in France for their own kind of sewing machine, right?
Yeah. It kind of created an overcast stitch. So if you don't know what that is.
I do not.
If you see like a situation where two pieces of cloth are bound together and there's a stitch that passes through each one and kind of spirals around the edges and then back through.
Okay.
That's an overcast stitch.
Okay. All right.
So this was similar. It's also called a whip stitch when you do it by hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very simple, but it could work on all different kinds of fabrics, and it was able to stitch curves.
Oh, okay. So it's not just a straight line like some of the other devices we'll be talking about.
Correct. Like a lot of them will only go in a straight line, but this one could handle curves.
That's pretty cool.
The one big drawback of it, though, was that it did not have a continuous thread feed. So there was a lot of stopping and going and rethreading of needles. And putting, so it saved time, we think, theoretically.
Right.
I say that with a question mark on purpose.
Right. Maybe it saves time for someone who just really hates the motion of actually making a stitch.
Well, or if you're doing like large scale things or
sure.
like leathers, it would probably help.
So that same year, you have John Duncan of Glasgow here patenting an embroidery machine, which is not quite the same thing as a stitching machine.
Correct. I mean, it does do stitches,
yeah.
but it's not the same sort of utilitarian things that would hold together pants.
Right.
It will just make the pants beautiful.
I've learned that through bitter experience. In 1807, we have Edward Walter Chapman and Walter Chapman. It's not confusing at all. Receiving a British patent, 3078. That's another thing that I think is interesting. You look at the history of sewing machines and you look at those patent numbers.
Yeah.
And when they're still in the four-digit range. That's incredible. Guys, go to the patent, go to like Google search for patents and look up any patent that's been issued over the last couple of years. We're talking in the millions here.
Yeah.
And this is when they were still in the thousands, which is pretty incredible. It really does show that the patent industry here was very young.
Oh, yeah.
This was the one that allowed a machine that had a needle that would not have to pass all the way through the fabric. It could just puncture it slightly and then pull back out and make the stitch that way.
Right, which is how modern machines still work
right.
for the most part. I think there are a couple of specialty machines that do different things. But yeah, so it had two needles, one, as you said, punched in and passed the thread down, another kind of shuttled through it, and then it got pulled back up so that would have continuous stitching via these two different thread feeds.
Cool. And then we have what my favorite name on our list.
It's
here.
One of my favorites, too.
1830. So it's Barthélemy Timonier.
Oh, I love a good French name.
Yeah, that's a great one. There's two TH's in there. And as I recall, that's a hard T, but I could be wrong.
It is. It is. And his machine made a chain stitch. And there are still machines very similar to this functioning today.
Mm-hmm.
They're not used a whole lot because it's one of those things you may have even come across them periodically. If you ever have like an article of clothing that's maybe not super pricey, you maybe bought it at, you know, a cheapy store, and you pull one thread and the whole thing starts coming out.
Yeah.
That's often a chain stitch.
Right.
Because
right.
it's the one thread holding everything together. So there's nothing stopping it from continuing to unravel.
Right. That's what I always get nervous now whenever I see a loose thread, and I'm more of a snipper than a tugger at this
I'm
point.
I'm not. I'm a yanker.
Okay.
But I know I can fix it if it all goes awry.
That's right. Yeah. For me, it's fixing means going out and buying a new one. We're going to pause on our stitching right now with the sewing machine and take a quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road into the wild, true blue, real-life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry, the Nissan Rogue has your back. Class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts? Time ends. Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
What I love about this story is it's interesting because it's a real life story that mirrors something that is a popular misconception. And what I mean by that is in the story, you have Timonier, who had a shop in Paris. Mm-hmm. He had lots of these different machines, 80 of them working at a time. And tailors, people who sewed by hand, stormed his store.
Yeah.
And destroyed some of the machinery because they didn't want to be put out of a job. And the reason why I say this is interesting is that there's a story that we have told on Tech Stuff before that is erroneous. And in fact, I have been guilty of pushing this forward. The idea of sabotage.
Yeah.
Being named after sabot, as in the French word for shoe.
Mm-hmm.
The story is that you had, often it's told about weavers who came in and threw their shoes into large mechanized looms in order to foul the workings and destroy them. As it turns out, that's not necessarily true. The first appearance of the word sabotage doesn't come until in the written word, as far as I can tell, until 1897, which tells me that this incident, which happened in around the mid 1800s, could have given birth to a word involving tailors that would have replaced sabotage, and they just didn't capitalize on it.
I want it to include timonier somehow. Timoniangers.
I got totally timoniered today at work.
Man, it hurts.
I walked in and they just ambushed me.
So they came and destroyed his shop and he had to flee. And he did get financial backing so that he could continue his work and develop new machines. But unfortunately, and he got some additional patents as well, both in France and in Britain. But the revolution kind of caused his legacy to get put on the back burner.
Yeah.
He kind of got robbed.
There were some important things that people were attending to at the time.
Yeah, not so much with the let's make machines.
Now we've got an American inventor coming up next. So let's just take a moment to go America.
Well, and he becomes very important in the patent battles.
Mm-hmm. So this is Walter Hunt you're talking about here.
Yeah. So he made a machine that it created a lock stitch. It used two thread sources, very similar to the bobbin and spool method you would see on modern machines.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, of course, was different than the single thread chain stitch of Timonier's successful machines.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of was a busy bee. He had a lot of inventions going at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like this sewing machine was his baby and he had really put his heart and soul into it. He was kind of like, nah, nobody's ever going to be interested in this. And he sold it.
So he sold the patent off to...
He didn't even have the patent. He just sold the plans off.
That's right. He didn't even patent this invention. He's like, I could use the money.
He sold it to a man named George A. Arrowsmith and was basically like, yeah, well, you know, I'll fund some other projects with whatever I make off of this.
Interesting.
It's not that important. As we said, he comes up later and becomes very important, so remember him. And we'll also point out his machine was one that Jonathan referenced earlier that would only go in straight lines. You couldn't really work curves with it.
Right. So that certainly limits its usefulness. Now, we also have to acknowledge the fact that there's a challenge in really talking about the history of the sewing machine because of an event that happened in the mid-1800s, early to mid-1800s.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a fire in the patent office.
Yeah, as it turns out, patents are flammable.
Yes.
No one had patented not the inflammable. That would also be flammable. But the impossible to burn patent.
Yeah, and it wasn't a time where they were making tons of backups. It was kind of like you file it and you go on your way. Because remember, we're still in the thousands. They haven't really gotten their game figured out yet.
Right, not to mention the fact that they're, you know, making duplicates is no easy task at this time.
No.
So they thought, well, it's safe enough.
Yeah, that fire was in 1836. So they really did not have a plan in place to keep duplicate copies. And as a consequence, there are actually a lot. Some sources will say that there are a lot of kind of partial patent documents that still exist that, like, they mention a needle or they mention something sewing related, but like the attribution portion of the document has been too damaged and they don't know who filed it. So there could be families out there that could have, for all we know, inherited great wealth, but we'll never know because
the capriciousness of fire robbed them of their place in history.
Fire and its ways.
Possibly on Martha's Vineyard. In 1842, we've got John J. Greenough, who is the first American to get a patent for the sewing machine that we have a record of anyway.
Yeah.
So even though he made his invention after Hunt had not patented it. And as you have in your notes here, the Arrowsmith apparently never got around to patenting it either. So this is the first one in the American patent system.
Yeah. He, there was, no replication of his. He basically kind of was one and done.
Yeah, so he made a prototype and then not a production model.
Yeah, yeah. We don't know if he didn't get funding or if he just abandoned the idea and moved on to something else. But it was only a year later when the second U.S. patent for a sewing machine came about, and that was issued to Benjamin W. Bean.
Which is a great name.
I know. and he created a unique development in that his machine was the first that actually fed the fabric through gears. So for the stitchers in the house, all three of us, that's similar to feed dogs. And if you don't stitch, what a feed dog is, if you've ever looked at a sewing machine, you may see these two, they almost look like little feet that come up and kind of kick at your fabric as you're sewing, and they have rigid edges.
Right.
And that's kind of pulling your fabric through as you go.
Right. So you don't have to put through as much effort. You don't have to worry about misguiding the fabric.
Right.
Yeah. So it helps feed the fabric through as you're stitching.
Yes. Sometimes it creates great drama and it eats fabric, but not very often.
Yeah.
And his also had a clamp mechanism to attach it to a table, so that was also a new development.
Oh, cool.
And there are still machines made that do that.
Also that year, in 1843, we got George H. Corliss, who, he was also a busybody making a steam engine.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. We did a full episode in Tech Stuff on steam engines, so if you guys are big into that and you really want to know about the development of the steam engine, here's an interesting little fact. The original steam engines didn't push with steam. They rather would pull by letting steam condense and create a vacuum, thus pulling a piston down rather than pushing a piston out. But we go into full detail on Tech Stuff, so I don't need to redo the whole thing.
Steam.
It's just pretty cool stuff.
It is exciting.
It's actually not cool. It's actually quite hot. But
ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, thank you.
So Corliss had what's considered the third U.S. sewing machine patent.
Mm-hmm.
His performed what is called a saddle stitch, which is a specialized stitch that's used to this day to join leather together.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of keeps it all stable. If anybody has ever tried to sew with leather, if you've had like a leather pouch or anything, it can present some challenges in terms of how it, because it's so rugged usually and tough, it will chew on threads. Or even if you have a lacing, the lacing, even though it's leather, also will kind of get chewed up over time.
Gotcha.
So a saddle stitch kind of gives you a tighter stitch, and it prevents some of that friction.
Mm, okay, cool. And then also just a year later in 1844, we've got James Rogers getting the fourth U.S. sewing machine patent. And you may all wonder why we're covering every single patent. The patent wars will make all clear, everybody.
It's going to become really apparent in a minute.
It's important because, again, we're trying to illustrate the fact that a lot of these patents were not revolutionary devices that completely reinvented the machine. They were sometimes incremental improvements that had a remarkable difference from earlier machines, but it was one tiny element, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily a full reworking.
Yeah. James Rogers' patent really only had a tiny change to Bean's design.
Uh-huh.
And that was that the gears were kind of in a different place, and that allowed him to be able to design a different needle that was shaped a little more simply and would be easier to replicate. And so pretty much every patent that came after this used this simpler setup,
right,
that built on Bean's design.
So it really set a precedent here.
But now we're getting to the star of the show.
Okay, who's the star of the show? Because not being a big sewing machine guy.
But you watched Schoolhouse Rock growing up, right?
I did.
He was in it.
Was he?
Yeah. In the Mother Necessity episode.
Oh. I'll have to go watch my DVDs.
There's a whole, Elias, can you help me with my sewing?
Oh, so it's an Elias here we're talking about.
Yes.
Elias Howell Jr.
Yes.
All right.
And there's even a play on his name where he tells her he's going to fix everything. And she says, Elias Howe. And it's very witty.
Ah, yes.
To the sewing nerds in the house.
Right. All three of you are
all
laughing.
All three of us cackling up a storm.
Off. So Elias Howe was born in Spencer, Massachusetts in 1819. And when he was a teenager, he decided to go and seek his fortune as a machinist, which was a brand new job in the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, he had some bravado. He was not afraid of kind of breaking out on his own and making his way in the world.
He certainly didn't appear to be shy once we get into the patent wars.
No, he was a very smart man.
Yeah. So he ends up as a machinist overhearing some talk about the idea of a sewing machine, and starts to kind of apply his own ingenuity How would I achieve this sort of thing? So he's important to remember.
Yeah. And he so he was granted the fifth U.S. patent in September of 1846. And it's one of those things, though, I have to laugh because every year when September comes around, you see the today on this day, Elias Howe invented the sewing machine. And I'm like, back up the truck. That's right. Not entirely accurate.
Right. It's like you know, Edison invented the light bulb. Yeah. All right. No, Edison improved
it's,
and
it's
made it
It's not a
practical.
Eureka moment yeah. where it comes from nowhere. Although he did sometimes say that, like, he had it kind of
fully
universally
formed in
his head. On his own.
That's very Tesla-like, too. Mm. Yeah. So this was patent number 4,750 in the United States. You know, the previous one we gave the number to was the British patent. So in both cases, you see that these are very, very early on during the patent office's existence.
Yeah, their numbering schemes were kind of neck and neck in terms of where they were at in terms of accession order.
Mm-hmm.
So this patent was actually his second version of the machine that he patented. He had another prototype a year before that was capable of sewing, but he fine-tuned it a little bit more. And Howe's patent is very important because it makes five very specific claims about how the machine is going to work. And they come up a lot in court battles later.
Right. Yeah, so this is where I was talking about how you can make claims within a patent. And those claims will protect elements of your invention. And claims can be everything from specific physical, mechanical ways that the machine works to a specific method, like an implementation. We see that today in ways that are less, they're more difficult to understand. Because if you're talking about a physical machine, you can say the physical machine does it in this way, and you can see whether or not the machine is actually doing it in that way. When we talk about today, we're talking about stuff like, you know, resizing images by pinching or moving your fingers further apart from each other. And it starts to get a little wibbly wobbly timey wimey when you are trying to say, oh, well, this is a method that is unique that I came up with and no one else can use it unless they come through me. It's one of those evolutions of the patent office that we're still trying to kind of reconcile.
Yeah, it's not all black and white, which is why you get into these huge battles and arguments and things go to court and you hear about Apple having to pay money, but then Samsung has to pay all the money.
And right. Yeah. And sometimes everyone just ends up like, well, let's just all say we gave each other the money we were supposed to and call it a day. But anyway, there were these five elements. Did you want to cover any of them? You have all of them written out here.
They are, and they're written out long because I cut and pasted it from another document. But I'll kind of do the short version.
Okay.
So the first was he describes how he's going to form a seam by using a curved needle to go through the cloth and a bobbin to kind of connect to that and make the stitch similar to how we've talked about before, this two-thread version.
Mm-hmm.
The second is how the thread is going to get lifted and pass through the needle eye. There's a lifting rod involved that's very important. The third is how the thread is going to be passed out by the shuttle. So it has a lot to do with the tension and how it passes through at a consistent rate. The fourth is how a couple of levers go together and enact their sort of mechanisms on the string or the thread that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the fifth is how the cloth is held in place by a baster plate, which is still a thing that happens. Like now, if you drop your foot down on your machine, it's kind of pressing the cloth onto the plate of your machine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what keeps it from going, just flying away when you're trying to stitch on it.
Right. Very important, as I understand it, in the sewing process.
Yes, most machines made today won't stitch at all if you don't have the presser foot down.
Right.
Because they know they'll just be wasting everyone's time.
Right. So Howe didn't meet with immediate success with this design, actually. He tried for a while to get people here in the United States excited about it, and no one seemed to really give him much attention. So he ended up selling the patent rights to a... or at least the British patent rights, I should say, to William Thomas for the princely sum of 250 British pounds sterling. I like the other note here. He also adapted his machine to make umbrellas and corsets.
I think that's fabulous.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in the market for both right now. So,
well, when we talked about this on history, Tracy was saying, I never thought about it before, but umbrellas and corsets really are quite a lot alike.
Yeah.
In that, you know, you have a casing and you have these rigid elements that pass through it and hold it all in shape.
Yeah.
And at this point, it would have been all steel bone corsetry. So it was very similar to an umbrella.
Right. Except that the main difference, at least in my experience, is that it's a relief to have an umbrella and a relief to get rid of a corset.
Oh, don't get me started. Corsets are good for you if they're well-fitted. They protect your back. They give you great posture. Those tight lacers are a whole different universe.
Yeah, I worked at the Georgia Renaissance Festival, so yeah. I have a very specific experience of watching ladies.
No. A good foundation corset will keep your clothes in place. It holds up all those Victorian layers, if it's a Victorian corset. So I'm kind of going from the time period we're talking about. They're not mystery torture devices.
Well,
they really were not intended for that use.
We'll clearly need to have you come in and give a talk. Because those ladies, let me tell you.
There is a lot of technology and physics in a corset.
I'm sure there are.
You either got a support from below or from above. It's fabulous.
Well, moving on in the evolution of the sewing machine, we move up to 1848 and the sixth U.S. sewing machine patent from John A. Bradshaw.
Which was a little bit snarky.
Was it?
Yeah, he talks about Howe's patent designs in his patent and kind of says that it's bungling and it's an encumbrance to the action of the machine when he talks about the needle.
So not only can Howe not get manufacturers interested in his device, he has the next patent petitioner completely diss him
totally
in the patent.
Trashing his work, even while he's building on it. He's still kind of like, he was onto something, but I really have this thing figured out.
Like, okay, well, I can tell you why it didn't do great with the manufacturers. Wonderful. So 1849, we get Howe coming back to the United States. He had gone to England, like we said, to sell the British patent off. And when he comes back, he sees that that what had been kind of a quiet little tiny niche industry was starting to take off.
Yeah. The seventh patent for the sewing machine had been issued to Charles Morey and Joseph B. Johnson in 1849. And they were really some of the first two that were like, we need to start selling this and making a bunch of them. And even before they received their patent, they were selling machines.
Uh-huh. Which is perfectly fine. I mean, it's not
you
don't have to have a patent. In fact, you often will see today things like patent pending.
Yep.
Where people are trying to capitalize on an idea. Because patent applications and patent grants can take a long time, especially today, now that you have an exponentially larger number of applications coming into the patent office than you did way back in the mid-1800s.
Yeah, there were some other people that were trying to improve on Morey and Johnson's machine in the middle of 1849, so that same year they got their patent. There was a man named Jotham S. Conant, and he was issued a patent based on a modification he made to their machine, which just kind of altered the way that the cloth was held during the stitching. But his never really went anywhere. He didn't manufacture. He didn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
But that same day that he got his patent, another important person was getting a patent.
John Batchelder. So, yeah, this was the continuous sewing mechanism and an endless belt to feed the cloth into the machine.
Yeah. Thank you, John. From me to you.
Yeah, to make sure that you don't have to put in all that work yourself. Yeah.
But the really important thing is who Batchelder sold his patent to.
And here we come up to the first name in this podcast that I recognize. I am Singer. Singer sewing machine.
Everybody knows that one.
Well, I mean, you know, my grandmother and my mom both had Singer sewing machines. In fact, the both of them still exist. My parents, it's like a little table that's next to the front door of their house.
Yep.
But it's an old Singer sewing machine that's operated by pedal.
Yep.
It's the one of those names that I
think most people associate it with sewing pretty quickly.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's still a name, so.
Yep, they're still making. You don't hear about a lot of Howe machines these days, but Singer's still going. So now we're to the argument phase.
It's time for us to take another quick break, but we'll be back with more about the sewing machine in just a moment.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road into the wild, true blue real life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry. The Nissan Rogue has your back. Class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
We finally reached the point now where things have come to a head. We've got the snippy little patent applications out of the way. Now it's time to really get down to fisticuffs, legally speaking. And it's the 1850s where we get that first enormous patent war. And it all has to do with the fact that these different little elements that have been improved upon over time, there were a lot of arguments about who actually had ownership of those ideas and in what implementations and who was owed money by whom, and it got ugly.
Really, really ugly. So there was a man by the name of Alan B. Wilson, and he, in 1850, was working on this lock stitch machine, very similar to the modern machine, and his mechanism could also go forward and backwards, mm-hmm. which we had not encountered before. Mm-hmm. And he applied for his patent. He had made a second prototype model, and the people that owned the Bradshaw patent from 1848 got wind of this and were like, hold on a minute, por favor. Mm-hmm. We own some of the concepts you're using. The double-pointed shuttle that made up a part of his machine was something that was part of their patent, they claimed. And right. that claim was not accurate. It was complete bunk.
So
however,
they think, well, let's throw a wrench into this one.
However, they had dollars and Wilson didn't, so he could not fight them.
Oh, so we get down to using the old idea of, well, if we can't suppress this idea one way, we can just kind of run them out because we've got a larger reserve of cash.
Yes.
Ugh,
so
ugly.
He had to give up half of his claim to A.P. Klein and Edward Lee, who at that point held the Bradshaw patent. And that was in late 1850 in November. Mm. And then after a little while, he just sold them the rest of his interest. He didn't want to mess with it anymore. He retained very limited rights.
That's a very sad story there, where essentially he was beaten down.
Yeah, he really had the goods in terms of his invention to have been the singer of this story in terms of name recognition, but because he just didn't have the means to fight anybody that made a claim against him, he vanished into history.
And to rub salt into the wound, they would use his name in official advertisements.
Yeah, people recognized that he had invented something really pretty exciting because it could do these things that previous machines couldn't. And so their advertisements went, A.B. Wilson's sewing machine, the best and only practical sewing machine, not larger than a lady's workbox, for the trifling sum of $35.
So not only does he not get the benefit of actually owning this device that he invented, he then has the indignity of having his name used in the advertising while this other company makes money off of it.
Yeah, he really did get shafted.
So, meanwhile, we've got Elias Howe, who, he's no dummy.
No, he's witnessing this and realizing some stuff is going down.
Yeah, maybe I need to kind of circle my little, my proverbial wagons here. So, he decides that he's going to protect the rights to royalties from his inventions. And anything that could trace elements of the products being sold back to one of his patents, right?
Yeah, and from the Bradshaw model on, they really were working on Howe's machine and kind of making
tweaks
to that. And then he really got angry because he saw one of Isaac Singer's sons demonstrating their sewing machine.
Yeah, and he said, some of these elements look awfully familiar. So, of course, he ends up doing the responsible thing. You know, he contacts Singer and says, actually, I own the patent for this machinery, this particular piece that you're using. And so by law, I should really receive a royalty payment because you're using it in your device and otherwise not compensating me for it. And so I'd really like that $2,000 you owe me. And Singer, being the very level-headed professional businessman, decided to physically threaten Howe.
Yeah. Singer was known for having a really bad temper.
Yeah.
He did some really seedy things just in business outside of this.
Yeah.
And when it came to this, there was one incident where he allegedly threatened and nearly threw Howe down the steps outside his office. Like, there were fisticuffs. It wasn't just yelling and arguing through lawyers. They were physically embattled.
I get the feeling that Singer is very much like the character from Pirates of the Caribbean who just says, you know, they're more like guidelines. he's not really one to necessarily be too concerned with the actual rules of law.
You know, that actor that plays Giacomo Gibb would make a great Isaac Singer. he would. But Howe did a super smart thing. This is where we really realize that this man was just really smart and very wily.
Mm-hmm.
So he, like some of these previous sad stories, really didn't have a lot of money to get into a lot of legal battles. But he figures out a way to finance some litigation. He sells half of his interest in his patent to a man named George Bliss. And Bliss manufactured machines. He billed them as being Howe's patent, even though they were pretty different from Howe's initial design.
Mm.
But the money that Howe made off of this partnership was basically put into his litigation machine, and he just started fighting people.
Oh, gotcha. So what he was doing was, he had made this partnership. He was making money off the partnership. Bliss is making money because of Howe's name.
Mm-hmm.
Howe is making money because of the partnership with Bliss. He ends up spending that money directly on lawyers to attack people who are actually infringing upon his patents.
Yeah, he went after Singer with great vigor, but there were a lot of other people that were also in this mix. Two of them, Leroux and Blodgett, that were a pair that were making, a firm that were making machines that he thought infringed. There was actually a judgment in that case in Howe's favor. That was the first one to be settled. And once it was like the first of the dominoes, because then everybody else kind of panicked and went, oh, wow, he really has a case.
Right. When you got a precedent set like that, then it becomes clear that it's going to get harder and harder to win a case, win a defense against such a claim. If a claim has already been held up in court in one instance, then the fear is that it will be the same in future ones. And it's cheaper to settle than it is to go through the process and then maybe have to be forced to hand over a larger reward in a court decision.
Yeah, and Howe was basically happy to, in these settlements, be like, okay, let's set up a license. Like, he was willing to deal with them.
Right.
It wasn't like he wanted to prevent other people from making their machines.
This is very different from what we see today. Yeah. We were talking about similarities, but today we got a lot of what we call them patent trolls.
Yeah.
These are the folks who will get a patent and then either they don't make anything on their own or they make something very, very tiny. And then they just kind of sit around and wait for folks to infringe upon them. They threaten litigation in hopes of a settlement. But what a lot of people have said about the recent patent wars is that the patent system needs to create an incentive for patent holders to license their ideas for royalties, which is exactly what Hal was doing back in this day.
Yeah. I mean, he really saw the benefit of like, hey, it would be a pain in the tuchus for me to set up my own manufacturing plant and be churning these out. But all these people are already set up. I can just cut deals with them. Everybody wins.
Yeah.
Except not so much.
No, it got ugly again. Apparently Singer was not done.
Yeah, he didn't settle. And so that case dragged on.
Yeah, and it got ugly in public too, right?
Yes.
You've got this great little story about two advertisements that ran on the same page of the New York Daily Tribune that tell very different stories.
Yeah, the first one reads, "The sewing machine. It has been recently decided by the United States court that Elias Howe Jr. of number 305 Broadway was the originator of the sewing machine now extensively used. Call at his office and see 40 of them in constant use upon cloth, leather, etc., and judge for yourselves as to their practicality. Also see a certified copy from the records of the United States court of the injunction against Singer's machine, so called, which is conclusive. You that want sewing machines, be cautious how you purchase them of others than him or those licensed under him, else the law will compel you to pay twice over."
Meanwhile, we have the other advertisement, sewing machines. "For the last 2 years, Elias Howe Jr. of Massachusetts has been threatening suits and injunctions against all the world who make, use, or sell sewing machines. We have sold many machines, are selling them rapidly, and have good right to sell them. The public do not acknowledge Mr. Howe's pretensions, and for the best reasons, one, machines made according to Howe's patent are of no practical use. He tried several years without being able to introduce one. Two, it is notorious, especially in New York, that Howe was not the original inventor of the machine combining the needle and shuttle, and that his claim to that is not valid. Finally, we make and sell the best sewing machines." So yeah, there's some vitriolic.
I love print. How it's like a sewing machine telenovela.
Yeah, there's a lot of soap opera going on here.
And to make it even more soap opera-ish, Howe went after Singer for libel, but he also went after the New York Daily Tribune for printing his advertisement in the first place.
So we now have Howe going after Singer both for patent infringement and for libel.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Just to make their relationship that much more delightful and huggy.
So at this point, Singer wakes up and just says, you were right. I was wrong. I'm going to be the bigger man and walk away, right?
Not even a little.
No.
He instead just kind of goes into a rage suitable to be played only by Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right, right.
And decides he's going to destroy Howe.
So this is Butcher Bill.
Totally. Completely.
Totally throwing a hissy.
He decides he is going to seek out every scrap of evidence on Earth. He even sought out sources in Europe and China to prove that Howe's design was not original. And the key here is that the wording in Howe's patent was really his protection,
mm-hmm.
because he had patented the combination of the shuttle and the one eye and the eye pointed needle, and how they would work together. But he never claimed to have invented either of those elements.
So
his patent remained accurate and correct and not infringing on anyone else.
Because he didn't say, "I invented the needle,
right.
I invented the shuttle." He said, "I invented this combination of these two elements that work in this particular way."
Correct.
And that is completely valid,
yeah.
in patent law. So again, if you come up with a new way to use existing technology that you can claim as an improvement over others, there's nothing stopping you from getting a patent on that.
Yeah, you can patent an interaction of things. They don't have to be physical things necessarily.
Right, right.
However, if you remember back when we talked about Walter Hunt, who is the guy who invented a pretty workable sewing machine, but then kind of sold it off and abandoned it.
Yeah, he never patented his particular idea.
Singer found him.
Of course he did.
Because he thought that was his best shot at bringing Howe down and showing that Howe was not, in fact, the first person to invent a working sewing machine.
So he just wanted to retroactively magically get a precursor patent that couldn't have existed because William Hunt never patented his invention.
That is exactly what he tried to do.
So this reminds me, I mean, there are entire books written about some of the more ridiculous things that have happened in patent law around the world, but particularly in the United States. So another good example of some shenanigans that went on with patents involves Tesla and radio.
Oh, yeah.
Because Tesla was awarded the patent in the United States the same year that Marconi actually filed for a patent. And mm-hmm. In fact, he received the patent a month before or 2 months before Marconi had filed for a patent in the U.S. And then famously, several years later, the patent office awarded – they went back on their decision, took the patent away from Tesla and awarded it to Marconi. So – even though that happens later, you know, the events we're talking about here are earlier in the timeline. It's not unusual for us to see these kind of crazy political dealings.
Yeah. And again, remember, you know, this wasn't a time when everything was duplicated and there was a trail of what had happened when.
Sure.
It would be easy to fudge things. So it's reasonable that Singer could think that he was going to finagle something out of this.
So what happens due to this claim?
Well, first Singer hires an engineer, William Whiting, to basically help resurrect Hunt's designs. He's going to go back to those original blueprints and schematics, and he's going to build it to prove that this one works and it's great, and how you got nothing.
Right.
The Scientific American at the time, as this was all bubbling up, actually published a pretty scathing article about Hunt asserting, because he was like, oh yeah, I did invent the sewing machine, now that he sees that there's money in it and this is a litigious thing.
Right.
They basically said that his claims were rusty. He had no hat in this game. Like,
right.
What was he trying to do?
He had no legal basis, really.
But there was a trial at the patent office.
Mm-hmm.
There were hundreds of pages of testimony. I mean, it went on forever. Singer dragged everybody in that he could think of that had ever touched anything that vaguely resembled a sewing machine. Patent Commissioner Charles Mason, though, ruled in favor of Elias Howe on May 24th of 1854. And the big part of Hunt's loss, even though he really did have a pretty good working machine, was that he didn't do anything to patent it or protect it 18 years prior.
Right.
So
The patent office can't rule in favor of someone who hasn't actually gone through the process of getting a patent.
Yeah, the commissioner was like, what are you trying to do? You don't have these rights.
Yeah.
Hunt did try to appeal to the circuit court of the District of Columbia, but that did not go so well either. Mason's ruling was upheld.
So then Howe, emboldened
Oof.
By this victory, decides to start going after other people that he has perceived as infringing against his patents.
Yep. Everybody that was selling a Singer machine, he went after.
Wow. That was a lot of people.
Yeah. And he asked for preliminary injunctions against all of them to shut down sales while they went through their court cases.
So he goes through this process, bringing it all the way to courts when necessary. The poor Singer at this point, not really poor Singer because he's kind of a jerk, but you've got Howe going after the people who are selling Singer sewing machines or incorporating them. Then what they're doing instead, you know, they get attacked by Howe. They turn around, they attack Singer saying, you got us into this.
Yeah. You had no right to sell us the licenses that you sold us because you didn't have a right to it.
Yeah. You didn't own the technology that you were licensing to us. And that's why we're in trouble.
Yeah.
So,
it's so litigious.
By 1854, keep in mind, this started in 1850.
Yeah.
By 1854, Singer and Howe settle their lawsuit. And it's announced in Scientific American. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
This is not tiny news. This is just like when you go on to Google News and you see like Samsung and Apple settle lawsuit. That's equivalent.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it reminds me of when those first like headlines were happening about, no, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates actually like each other. It's fine. It's like that level of, wait, what? We didn't think that's how this worked. Except there was very little pushing down of stairs in any of them.
Right. Well, what's really cool about this? Okay, so this didn't end all litigation. There was still some continuing on.
No.
But by 1856, we get the president of Grover and Baker, which was one of the companies involved in the suits that were involving Elias Howe.
I feel like we should back up because we skipped that people tried to then sue Howe for improving on his original design.
Sure.
So Howe basically at this point was the, you know, the czar of the sewing machine industry. He owned the patent to the biggest chunk of it.
Yeah.
And was licensing those out. And he thought, well, you know, I could really tweak that original design as well.
Mm-hmm.
But every tweak he made, other people claimed they had already made. So then he was getting sued by people for patent infringement for improving on his original design.
Okay. So now
it's a litigation festival, basically.
So now you've got people saying, all right, well, these improvements you're making, we've already made and we've already patented. So it's become a huge mess. By 1856, you get the president of Grover and Baker, which was one of the companies that was involved in these cases against Howe about these improvements to the original designs, and comes up with a concept called the combination, which, by the way, these days we would call this a patent pool.
Yeah.
And a patent pool is essentially when you get a whole bunch of different stakeholders who all own different patents that are involved in the same general technology to essentially come to an agreement saying, all right, we're going to pool all these patents together. And as long as we are all officially part of this group and we all agree to operate by these rules, we're not going to sue the pants off each other whenever we make an improvement to that technology or incorporate that technology into our products.
Yes.
Make sure that everyone's getting the royalties that they deserve.
Exactly. So the president of Grover and Baker was Orlando B. Potter. And he, you know, I feel like he's a person that's not very well known historically, mm-hmm. but he really deserves a lot of kudos because he was really the first person to go, hey, you guys, we're only hurting ourselves. We're kind of being idiots.
Yeah.
And he really established this concept of what is now a patent pool. So he was like, let's stop, you know, holding up everybody's production. Let's stop throwing our money at lawyers. We don't need that. We can work this out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got them all to join their forces. They pooled their patents. They made one unified combination patent for sewing machines. Howe initially was not on board with this.
Well, no, when you own a huge chunk of the landscape, then you feel like you have the most to lose
and
in that kind of agreement.
He definitely felt that way. But eventually he did agree to it. He had made some pretty heavy stipulations and the other parties agreed. Basically, he was going to get a $5 royalty on every sewing machine that was sold in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And for every sewing machine that was exported, he would get a dollar. Now, remember, this is in 1856, so these are not paltry sums.
No, this is significant money.
So in the next 11 years, so between 1856 and 1867, when Howe's patent expired, he made more than $2 million. And that's $2 million in 1800s money.
Yeah, that's
way more, but he would be a kajillionaire.
Yeah, crazy rich.
That's my math.
Crazy
He's
rich.
A kajillionaire.
No, I think that was accurate estimation there. And he requested an extension to that patent, but was denied. Patents do, like I said earlier, expire. And when they expire, you lose that exclusivity. You cannot demand licenses for it. That technology, that implementation of that technology then belongs to the public. So anyone can create any kind of device using that sort of approach that was originally covered by that patent that's now expired. So he doesn't get the extension he wanted. And he dies of a broken heart.
He doesn't really die of a broken heart. His heart was broken earlier in his life when his wife died, but it did not kill him to the best of our knowledge. However, some say that it did kind of spur his litigation
decline.
Fest because he needed to focus on something else.
Yeah.
But Singer, of course, continued to work his magic in the sewing machine industry. And now, as a consequence, you know, he's really the name we remember more than Elias Howe.
Yeah. Yeah, you see that name all over the place.
He was exceptional at marketing.
Very much, again, kind of like Edison, who was brilliant in many ways. And one of the big ones was that he was a very smart businessman and marketer. So, yeah, this is, again, you can see the parallels with modern patent wars. Everything from the cooperation of various companies to make sure that business can continue. The arguments that patent litigation harms innovation,
yeah.
that sitting on patents harms innovation. These are not new ideas.
No, not at all.
You've got to look at, early to mid-19th century, and you can see it all there as well. So very interesting that there's so much in common with what we see today.
That wraps up this classic episode about the sewing machine. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have suggestions for topics I should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, reach out to me on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at nissanusa.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.